Recording in progress. Recording stopped.
Eso sí. Mm.
Guest house. Ita rile lambi rile leti mali ta nwe loko humesa tsene ti humesa ti tsi. Rile ka buru. Ya bo. Eh kure why abathe why tere ko yi.
Okay.
O va ba ku shoda.
Ba bani.
O. Ni malu mo ame. Gena.
Ya le shoda na. A shoda la so ngabo ya si a si bu su su ta.
Good morning, Chair. Who is this Thabo?
Honorable members.
Who is this Thabo, Nontando?
Hey, I'm not sure, Chair. Let me quickly check.
Hi, Thabo. Is he gone now?
Yes, I've muted. I've unmuted. Sorry, I've muted his mic, Chair.
Chairperson. Chairperson.
Principal.
Why seems as if our meeting is invaded? What is up?
You must tell me that person speaks your language. I think.
No, I don't know the person.
That is the person. He is speaking your language.
No, he's not speaking my language.
What language is that?
It's Yangan.
So it's not a Limpopo language?
No, it's Suela's language.
No, maybe Chelepa and mute him and ask him who he is.
That's what I was trying to do, and then he did not respond. Thabo, morning, how are you? Thabo?
Who gave him the link?
No, but the links are public as well. So this is a public meeting. We are supposed to be starting. We'll deal with it as we proceed. Members, today we are having Onoluthando Skakha as our secretary. Llewellyn is not well. He is in hospital for minor eye operations. So Ms. Skakha will be helping him for today and the next week, so for 2 weeks. I don't want you to be surprised that who is this one now? It is in Mr. Brown's place. So can we ask you, Nontando, to assist us with the roll call?
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, honorable members, and everyone present in the meeting. Chair, when I checked the attendance of the members, I saw Honorable Fanzi, Honorable Letsie, Honorable Mashabela, Honorable Sukers, Honorable Muratsehla, Honorable Adwons, Honorable Bozo.
Okay. Is there a member that she might have left? Because we'll all understand that she is not really serving our committee. Is there a member that was not mentioned who is in the meeting?
I'm Susan Bowman. I'm from Blind.
No, we're looking for members of parliament.
We're sorry about that. Sorry.
Okay. In the absence of any member of parliament, then do you have apologies, Noltando?
Yes, Chair, I've got two apologies. One apology from the minister, and the other one is from the deputy minister. They are both attending the cabinet lekgotla, sitting at the same time as the meeting. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Thank you very much, sis. Will you help us to fly to the agenda?
Chairperson, I'm present, ma.
They did mention you, Paita. After a long time, how are you?
Later.
Okay. Members, today we are going to be dealing with the department will be briefing us on the draft rural education policy, which will be including the regional closure, and they will also be briefing us on the rationalization and measures. And then we'll have deliberations and the responses. And then there are minutes of the 14th of June, of the 28th of June, 8th of August that we need to adopt. So this is today's agenda. Can I get honourable members to adopt the agenda? Lizia?
Good morning, Chairperson, honorable members, the department, and all other people who may be on the platform. My name is Teboho Lizia. I move for the adoption of the agenda as it is. Thank you.
Thank you very much, honorable Lizia. Honorable Adwons?
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, honorable members. Good morning to a delegation from the department and everyone in the platform. I move also to second the adoption. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Thank you very much, Honorable Adwons. Members would recall that the meeting we're having actually today that
recording in progress
on the rural development, I mean on the rural schooling, and it's because of then we had a petition that was sent to us by one of our members who is honorable Sukers. And based on that petition, we summoned her, which she came together with the community members that were affected from the province of the Western Cape. And we have listened to them. But you would recall that we have concluded by saying that we are going to ask the department to come and brief us on this rural policy together with the rationalization thereof. So we are only dealing with that meeting today, because then we could not really, we did not even ourselves understand the policy, what does it entail. And such decisions are taken because of why would the department, or rather its provinces, take such decisions. But I think this meeting today will be able to put us on a greener light in terms of understanding how does the rural schooling works, and who qualifies, and on basis, whoever that qualifies, qualifies, and the implementation thereof, from one province to the other. So I'm going to hand over to the General, Utato Mueli, to lead the department. And when you are done, DG, you can then delegate whoever to proceed with the presentation. DG? He is most in the meeting, or not so?
Chairperson, I don't see. Good morning. This is Kimala Gaya speaking here. And good morning to everyone. I don't see DG in the meeting. So, unless he, sometimes uses a different gadget, but I don't see him here. If you
no,
would...
Fine. You can proceed, Ms. Gaya. I saw his name. He was in the meeting. Maybe he just got disconnected. But you can proceed, then it's fine.
Thank you very much, Honorable Sir. So, yes, we are here today to do two presentations. They emanate from the previous discussion that we were in a special meeting where we had to speak to particular matters around a school that was highlighted, the closure of that school, and we were then asked to come and speak specifically to issues around what is our policy position and how do we actually deal with matters around rural education and around the closure and merger of schools. And so we're here today to do exactly that. We have two presentations that will be done by two persons. So Dr. Langa will do a presentation on rural education, and Mr. Ndlebe will do a presentation on the closure and merger of schools. And the first one will be Dr. Langa's, which gives a broader context around rural education. And then Mr. Ndlebe will come in on the specifics around the closure and merger of schools that will unpack the procedures that have to be followed. So I'm not sure, Chairperson, if we can then start with these two presentations in the order that I'm explaining.
Yes.
Good morning, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members and DGG and colleagues. This presentation will give us a broad context of how we at the DBE are supporting rural schools. Next slide, please. Presentation. The presentation outline is not going to be a long presentation. We are going to explain why there is a great need for the National Rural Education Framework, and also explain the transition from policy to a framework. Next slide, please. Because initially we speak of a policy, but now we have a rural education framework. We're also going to discuss framework content and the recommendations, and also how as the DBE we have responded to the framework through our pilot project. Next slide, please. Okay, this slide responds to two questions. One, why do we need to have a rural education framework? And the second question is, how will the framework assist the sector to blend better to support rural schools? Rural schools exist all over the world. They're a global phenomenon and will always be part of education systems.
So we need to plan for them and make provision, hence the National Framework for Rural Education. The framework is premised on the notion that context matters in the education sector. It context in general, whether rural or urban, and rural context in particular. The framework is assisting us to move away from a one-size-fits-all to a more relevant programs in rural education. It also conscientizes us not only to be context-specific when responding to the needs of rural schools, but to also be context-sensitive because of the many challenges that these schools are experiencing. It does advocate for context-specific and context-sensitive approach in dealing with these schools. Next slide. Okay, and this one is important because it tells us why we have moved from policy, we have transitioned from policy to framework. We do know that the minister approved the appointment of the research team, which used a consultative and research-based approach to develop the policy, and the draft policy was presented and approved, and it was gazetted in December 2017, and we received a lot of public comments, and these were inputted into the policy and from several organizations. But we presented the framework to all important structures, and CEM then recommended that we convert the policy into a rural education framework. Next slide. And we took the policy back to the provinces because provinces had to make a decision, and 6 out of the 9 provinces also recommended that it becomes a framework and not a policy. So we changed this into a framework, presented again to all the important structures, and the 7th of July, the draft framework was presented to CEM and was approved. So we now do not have a draft framework, but we have a national framework for rural education that has been officially approved. Next slide. Okay, the framework has pillars. And it's important to know that no changes were made. It's still the policy, the contents that were there when it was a policy. It was just changed into a framework. Next slide. Okay, the first pillar is access and inclusivity. Under this one, we talk about something that is very important, which was a challenge before, how we define rural in the context of South Africa. The definition of rural is a challenge all over the world. So we thought, let's look at the South African context and see how we can define rural. Rural areas are areas that consist of the tribal lands controlled by traditional leaders. We're also talking about settings that are sparsely populated and where agriculture is the major means of economic activity. Areas of dense settlement that were created by colonial and apartheid-driven land settlements. And also we add in mining areas in rural context where mining is no longer active. Okay, the next slide also explains how, because within rural areas in South Africa, there is diversity as well and there is inequity as well. There are deep rural areas and there are rural areas that are just in the periphery of urban areas. So how then are we going to overcome the rural challenges when we implement the projects and the programs that we have? Then we partnered with Stats SA to try and classify and come up with the classification of rural schools. And together we identified these indicators that can assist us to do that. One is location, whether it's public schools, and not only geographical location, but whether it's public schools in rural areas which are situated in government land or communal land or private land, that will primarily be farms or attached land. We also identified a second indicator, which is school factors, which is school phase, teacher-learner ratio, educational facilities such as LTSM, libraries, laboratories, but here we're looking at the resources and infrastructure that is available in that particular school. We also identified cultural, social, and economic factors, as well as physical features, which talks to services, transport, terrain, and distance from services and facilities. And here we're talking about services that are relevant to education. Next slide. Again, under access and inclusivity, we also guide on how early childhood development can be supported. Most of the ECD areas in rural schools are mostly in primary schools. There are very few that are community-based, that are run by NPOs, and very few that are private. So we want to ensure that primary schools are expanded to absorb these young children going into grade R, and that there are appropriate resources, qualified practitioners, and material resources as well. And where required, we are asking that the infrastructure should be repurposed for grade R intake, and where it is insufficient, additional infrastructure should be made available. Again, in inclusive education, we are saying we need to use the edu villages, and this concept will be explained later, so that there are special units that deal with specialized training for educators, including inclusive education as well. We are saying the DBE should strengthen the monitoring of the current inclusion model in special needs and full service schools in rural context. And that reporting, when we're supporting not only special schools, but any school, should be differentiated between rural and urban, so that we are able to monitor the performance and successes in our rural schools. Next slide. Under access and inclusivity as well, we talk about availing ICTs to rural areas. Again, new villages should serve as hubs from which various kinds of ICT-related services can be accessed by both educators and learners. So we're saying these villages should be used as ICT hubs for teacher training as well as for learning and learning for learners. And incorporated into all facets of learning and teaching as well. Infrastructure, the physical infrastructure must be made available in rural schools, and it should meet the standards according to the norms and standards for school infrastructure. And we are saying there should be special infrastructure that should be considered for sparsely populated areas where small schools are located. And that additional infrastructure, as explained before, should be made available for ECD intake. Next slide. The next pillar is on mobilizing rural communities. This came as when we were doing research, showed that there's a disjuncture between what happens in rural schools and the community needs. So under the pillar, we're saying we need to enhance community participation in educational affairs. And it remains one of our main pillars, because we're saying everything that is done in rural schools should involve community participation as well. The framework proposes recruitment of EAs to provide support in curricular and co-curricular and administrative activities. And we've piloted this project under the RIP successfully. A research document is available, and we're now in the process of developing a framework for education assistance. We're also saying we're not limiting involvement of rural communities to young people. We also need all the people to share and to share in the development initiatives that involve agriculture, mining, fishing, wildlife management, and nutrition as well. And it's important that we establish partnerships between the schools and local communities as well to support teaching, learning, and well-being. Next slide. The next pillar is on harnessing and strengthening existing curriculum to better respond to the needs of rural communities. And here it's important to explain that we're not saying there should be a different curriculum for rural schools, but we need to harness and strengthen the existing one as well. Here we talk about agricultural education for all, and we're saying that agriculture can play a very important role in economic development in general and rural socioeconomic development in particular. So we need to formalize agriculture as a teaching subject, mostly in rural schools, and also expand focus schools for agriculture and have funding that is ring-fenced for agriculture and ensure that they are qualified teachers as well to enable the expansion of agriculture. But we also have to explain that the framework started in 2015, but now we are saying that all focus schools that are there in the DBE should be rural learners should also benefit from them, not only agriculture. Next slide. We also recommend the enhancement of the because these three things are very important in rural spaces. So we are proposing that we need to strengthen the teaching of these subjects. We need to, we require placing value on indigenous activities and resources that are inherent to rural spaces. So we propose that focus schools for arts, culture and sports should be expanded in rural areas, and there should also be technological advances which should be leveraged to enhance the curriculum. And also we need to invest on LTSM and in the teaching of these subjects, and we need to encourage schools to offer these subjects as well. Next slide. We also stress the importance of supporting reading, numeracy and literacy in rural schools. We're saying these are the cornerstones for future employability and further studies. So the framework proposes the strengthening of these skills in rural areas through initiating projects that aim to increase this, something that we've started doing already, making available the necessary LTSM, and also deploying education assistance to facilitate reading and math clubs. As in our pilot project, this has proved to be very successful and it did increase performance. Next slide. The next pillar is on teacher recruitment, retention, and development. Next slide. Well, we do know that it's difficult to recruit, retain, and develop teachers in rural settings due to distances from towns, poor infrastructure, and limited civil service delivery. So to address these challenges, we are saying that we need to create a package of teacher incentives that goes beyond finances and include teacher development, career progression, transport, accommodation, recreation, and other essential services. In other words, if we address these things, we will make teachers stay in rural contexts. So we propose the establishment of edu villages with the intention of providing accommodation for teachers, and this concept came from the concept of agri-villages, and it said if this was, that was a success, then we can also establish edu-villages. These edu-villages should also serve as hubs for teacher development activities to provide ICT-based programs. A good example of this is that when it comes to teacher development, we know that the face-to-face workshops in rural areas can be problematic because in small schools, because of distance as well, it can mean that teaching and learning is disrupted. So we're saying we promote the ICT-based one where teachers can remain in school but still be part of all these workshops. We're also recommending recruitment and appointment of EAs to provide support to teachers as a way of enhancing teacher well-being. And it doesn't just end there. Those EAs who are recruited to rural schools must be encouraged to do initial teacher education training through school-based teacher education programs using various modes, whether distance, online, or block sessions, where they do face-to-face. And we are partnering with some of the higher education institutions. Next slide. Okay, the last pillar is the support to schools in unique circumstances. Next slide. And we thought it was important to explain what we mean by schools in unique circumstances. One, it's small primary schools with 135 learners, which offer multi-grade teaching. Small secondary schools with 200 learners, which are the only means of access to education in some of the communities, and the schools that struggle to recruit and retain teachers in scarce subjects. And it's important to explain because this links to rationalization. We are continuing with the process of rationalization of the closure and measure of small schools, but we're saying that in viable schools that meet the requirements, then those schools need to be supported. But it has to be schools that are viable, where there is teaching and learning that is going on. So the framework recommends that we need to have a minimum number of teachers to be determined for primary and secondary school. And we know that there are provinces that have done this. The appointment and deployment of itinerant teams of educators who will be based in district offices and move from one school to the other. And there is a province that is already doing this successfully. And we're also recommending the use of education assistants to provide support to teachers in these schools with the hope that there would also be teachers and stay in rural context. Next slide. Okay, so what are the roles and responsibilities that are set out by the framework? At national level, we have recommended these structures which will assist to advise on how we can support rural schools, and also which will improve collaboration with other departments. A national team that will also be part of support to rural schools and then inter-provincial rural education committees, and some of the committees are already in existence. And we also talk about the support at provincial level and what needs to be done there. Next slide. We have recommended that there should be an establishment of dedicated directorate or sub-directorate, and this will be guided by the number of rural schools for rural education. There are provinces that have dedicated directorate and have appointed directors for rural education, and some sub-directors because of the number of rural schools, which is not much. We also recommend that in provinces, so that there is dissemination of information and also provinces are able to report how they are supporting rural schools, and also a team that will also support the implementation of the framework. So we recommending that there should be an establishment of a provincial rural education committee that interpret national policies, prepare implementation plans, and also coordinate the activities embracing rural education across the province. And this will also allow monitoring and evaluation to be done successfully. Next slide. We also recommend the same for district offices. We're saying that there should be a district rural education committee that will speak to the provincial rural education committee. This one will oversee, because they are closer, oversee and monitor the implementation process and also support schools. And to strengthen this committee, we're saying we need to, provinces need to, through districts, allocate a dedicated person responsible for rural education in all districts, and also facilitate the training of SGBs in specialized functions arising from the framework. Next slide. We also recommending what should be done at school level, where, because mobilizing rural communities is the strongest pillar in the framework. So we're saying that we need to mobilize schools, need to mobilize the communities to enhance participation of the broader school community and various stakeholders in school development, and also identify and harness resources that will assist in improving their schools. The next part of the presentation talks about how the DBE has responded to the National Framework for Rural Education. It took us a long time to finalize this because we wanted consultation. We wanted proper consultation, rather, and we also wanted a research so that we come up with a good framework. So while we were developing it, we also had pilot projects that supported the contents of the framework. One of them is mobilizing rural communities. We have piloted a project called the Rural Education Assistance Project, where participation of rural communities was a central pillar. That was piloted between 2018 and 2021, where we employed education assistants, about 900 of them, youth from rural communities, to work in 188 schools. To see how the use of EAs can improve quality of education in rural schools, and also to provide enhanced livelihoods for unemployed youth in rural communities. And the most important one was that the recommendations of this pilot project were to be used to develop a framework for effective deployment of education assessment, the process that is on now. These young people assisted in curricular and extracurricular activities, and they significantly contributed to teacher well-being, as well as the reduction of youth unemployment, and thereby contributing to livelihoods in communities. Next slide. Okay, under the same project, we also had an agriculture education project. We have developed a concept document on agricultural education, which guided the implementation of a self-sufficient agricultural school. And this was meant to try and expand agricultural education, agricultural schools rather, in rural areas. This was piloted in one school in Limpopo, and it became a success. Next slide.
Chairperson.
Principal.
Yeah, man, unless if it is my gadget, but the presenter is fainting every minute, and she's not that much audible. I'm just saying so, not unless it is only my gadget.
No, she's fine with me. I don't know with other members.
She's fine, Chair.
Yeah, then...
Gadget, you are in the bundus, it's yourself, man. Please.
Osha, but she can approach a mic a little bit for the benefit of us all. Thank you.
Okay, I'll do that.
Okay.
Okay, one of the pillars that we've also implemented is harnessing and strengthening existing curriculum to better respond to the needs of rural communities. We've done that through Enabling Rural Schools Project, which is a project that deals with the foundation phase learners, and it also focuses on the central role of school leadership, and it foregrounds Reading for Joy as an essential building block to promote quality education, achievement, and progress. This one is implemented in the Northwest, and it's supporting the development and use of locally produced LTSM through the development of materials in the local language, which is IsiZwana. Learners under this project are not only taught, given opportunities to read, but they are also developing books in their own language, and these are learners at the foundation phase. Next slide. Through the same project, the next project is the Edulution Project, which is piloted in KZN and Mpumalanga, which talks to access and inclusivity, and specifically the ICTs. We have provided tablets to learners, and the project is meant to improve the educational outcomes for learners who participate in it, specifically in maths. And it's also aimed at reducing unemployment and promote enterprise development, because we've in the next slide, we'll show that we've employed about 65 young people from rural areas to work as coaches. Next slide. Yeah, and about 6,900 learners are benefiting from this project, and it is a pilot project, and the reports from this will determine whether this project will be done in all provinces, and it's privately owned. Next slide. Yeah, the framework is also big on partnerships, and that's what the Rural Education Directorate has embarked on. The first thing that we target is rural youth employment opportunities. All our projects have created opportunities for rural youth employment and also for improving maths and reading. We spoke about the RIF already, 900 young people benefited from this. The Edulution Project, we employed 65 young people, and they're working the course of 3 years, and also the ERSP, we've employed 60 young people to work as community reading champions for the next 3 years. And we are very big on public-private partnerships, because all these projects are privately funded. Next slide. And this concludes our presentation. Thank you.
The next one.
Chairperson, it's Mr. Ndlebe who will come on. Mr. Ndlebe, if you could please come on now.
Thank you, Chairperson. It was a struggle with the muting and the unmuting. Is the presentation visible, Chairperson?
Not to me.
I'm trying again.
It is visible now.
It is visible. Thank you very much, Chairperson. That is the list of items that we will go through in this presentation. And we really want to request the Portfolio Committee on Basic Education to note the presentation on the regional measure closure of small and non-viable schools. We're starting off, Chairperson, with a legislative framework. where we find the powers to do what we do around rationalization of schools. It is in section 12A of SASPA, where the MEC of Education in Province is given the authority to merge two or more schools. And it is section 33.1, where the MEC is also given the powers to close a school. And it actually indicates that this is a provincial competency. It goes on to indicate that there are regulations. The regulations relating to the minimum uniform norms and standards for public school infrastructure also give direction on how this happens. So you look at regulation 5.3, Roman figure 2, that provides that a primary school should have a minimum of 135 learners, and a secondary school should have a minimum of 200 learners. It also goes on section 5, to indicate that there are two types of schools in the country. One type is a primary school, which should start from grade R to 7. And another type of school is a secondary school, which must have grade 8 to 12, and nothing in between. What you're looking at now is how schools are classified and defined from a small school to a mega school, that a small and a micro school is a primary school with 135 learners. And then it goes on to indicate what is a large school in a primary school. Then the secondary schools is 200, and a mega secondary school will be a school that has more than 1,000 learners. The next one shows that division that says a school is a primary school, R to 7. A school is a secondary school, 8 to 12. Now, in the country, we still are faced with schools that have missing grades. There are grades that are just in between. For example, in the Eastern Cape, in Limpopo, and somewhere in Northwest as well, you still have junior secondary schools. You sometimes have senior secondary schools. And there are also intermediate schools and combined schools in the country. So these pieces of legislation that have gone through were trying to do away with these missing grades in schools and arrange them as R to 7, 8 to 12, and nothing in between. So the process that we're engaged with, the rationalization of schools, means also to align these misaligned schools so that we only have two types of schools in the country. The aim of this rationalization, the merging and the closure of school, is to promote access to schools, to expedite resourcing of schools. We're dealing with pit latrines, we're dealing with infrastructure, we're dealing with the provision of water. It becomes much quicker when schools are grouped and we have more learners in particular schools. But what I want to focus on is the one that says we're merging and closing schools in order to improve the quality of education. What it means is that a small and non-viable school is unable to offer all the curriculum that the children need to go through. If it's a secondary school, chances are that in a small school, the number of teachers provided at the ratio of 1 to 35 will not be able to teach all the subjects that are supposed to be taught in that particular school. Same applies to children that are found in a primary school. They are unable to receive that. It's difficult to draw the timetable. To give you an example, a child who is in a foundation phase grade 1 and grade 2 is supposed to have 23 hours of tuition per week. Now, if it's a small and non-viable school, it is not possible for each child to receive that amount of time given. The child needs to have between 7 and 8 hours of home language teaching per week. The child needs to have about 2 to 3 hours of additional language in those grades. And if you go to other grades, such as your intermediate phase,
then children need to be exposed to 27 and a half hours of tuition, with 6 hours dedicated to home language, 5 hours dedicated to additional language, 6 hours dedicated to math, and start going down to 3 on different subjects that are in there. You can continue with that type of analysis until you go even to FET phase, where in FET is also 27 and a half hours of teaching, where children need to receive 4.5 hours for language, for all languages, mathematics 4.5, and about 3 to 4 hours in other subjects that are there, making it a total of 27. So if it's a small school, it can have those teachers that will cater for those. So it means children are taught a few of the subjects instead of all subjects. Even the subjects that they are taught, they are not getting all the full hours as prescribed by the caps. They end up getting very less hours. So these children, should they proceed and get into even grade 12, it becomes a challenge for them to even compete for spaces at universities and other tertiary institutions, because their standard is very compromised. They haven't gone through the required amount of work that they should have done. So when you look at rationalization, we're saying rationalization is not about reducing the number of schools at all costs. The department is not really desperate to be reducing the number of schools. And we are not compromising access by denying certain learners to get into schools. Rationalization is also not about addressing poor performance or challenges around educators and principals. So in some instances, people refuse to have their schools measured closed because they will say, no, the school has lost numbers because of its underperformance. It's not a reason that we look at. What we're looking at is, how are the children benefiting in the classroom? Are they getting all the tuition that they deserve? Rationalization is not for us to settle scores and try and discipline some people by closing those schools where they are. We give a definition of what it is. We say it is a carefully planned and systematically executed process towards ensuring continued universal access by learners to quality education in a rational manner, doing so cost effectively with respect to resource provision. Now, the department has this responsibility to provide sufficient, purpose-built, safe, and accessible school facilities and the cost-effective way. So, as a department, we worried about the quality of education, and that is why we try and group these schools in order to provide them. But the concerns that we have around these schools is that teaching and learning is compromised in small and non-viable schools. If you go and check our NSC results and look at schools that are giving us 0% pass rate, 10%, 20% metric pass rate, you realize that these are small and non-viable schools. And not through fault of their own, is because it is just impossible to provide tuition, all subjects, and all hours that are supposed to be there. There are limited choice subject choices in those small non-viable schools. In a community, you'd want children that will select between the sciences, between the commerce subjects, and others to do the general subject. But in a small and non-viable school, then children are forced to do or follow a particular stream. Children in small and non-viable schools are unable to compete in extracurricular activities effectively. We're talking of children that are about 50 in a school and so on. They cannot excel in sporting activities and other curricular activities. Now, when we look at our investment, return in investment, it gets compromised. At the moment, we are challenged in offering those dealing with pit toilets, provision of water, provision of electricity. But if there are too many schools that are non-viable and scattered all over, it becomes a problem. So what we look at when we try and measure or those schools, it's a number game. We look at the number of learners, and we look at curriculum consideration, the timetable, and what the school can offer. We look at the accessibility of the school. Can children walk around? Can they be transported? Can they be housed in another school? So we look at complete infrastructure. That if we are to merge two schools, one of the two schools should be having a better infrastructure, and then we'll try and maintain and renovate that. We were looking at a reclassification of those misaligned schools like junior primaries and middle schools. And that's what we do when we look at this. But it says, when the MEC considers to merge or close school, according to Section 33.2 of SASA, the MEC is compelled to follow certain rules, certain stages. And the first one is that one of consulting with the LGB and indicate his or her own intention and provide reason why that school needs to be merged or to be closed. The LGB needs to be granted an opportunity to make a representation. And then the MEC needs to ensure that the provincial department conducts public hearing and give reasonable notices to community to also make their own representation. Then the MEC will then consider those recommendations and make a decision out of it. So we're saying the merger and closure of school is not at all cost. We are not about to close every small school. There are considerations that are taken into when we do that. For example, we look at whether the school has a prospect of learner growth. So this is a period that will take between probably more than 3 years, where MEs will be studying the trends of that community and the school itself. If there is an indication that this small and non-viable school has the potential of growing, then it doesn't come into the list of those identified for closure. We ensure that there should be all legislative processes that are adhered to, such as the written notices and the gazetting of the processes and the consultations that take place. We also ensure that human resource related matters are attended before we could also merge or close a school, and look at the officials that deal in infrastructure, that they really ensure that the children are moved into a place that is suitable. Provision of transport, it's key, and all the other support processes that the department must put in place before a school is met. So if these things are not there, we're saying no micro school, irrespective of the numbers, can be closed if those legislative processes such as consultation and notices have not taken place, if we are not sure of the human resource issues. If we can't provide scholar transport, we cannot identify school and leave it until such time that the department can commit to providing transport. What provinces do now when they close small and non-viable schools, they then take these children to hostels and build mega schools in those hostels and keep the children there and transport them sometimes over the weekend to their homes, but all the children will then be housed. So we're saying, if we're not ready as a department to provide accommodation, to provide transportation, then those schools remain open as long as we are still trying to find ways to accommodate those children. Now, because this is a slow process, it can take up to a year to 2 years just to deal with the logistics of merging and closing a school. The Director General felt it was important to strengthen the team that deals with merger and closure of schools. And what he did was to bring all his directors general and make them responsible for this process under DG Gaya. And he also requested provincial departments to do likewise and appoint senior officials that work with senior officials of the department to go through the processes of merger and closure of identified schools. That is the list of the DDGs and the senior managers from each province that the department engages with on a regular basis to ensure that the process is done correctly. At the lower level, below the DDGs, that is where some of us sit in a project committee. This project committee your management and governance, governance being the most important aspect because of governing body. Lawyers of the department who play a role in giving advices and ensuring that all these processes are followed to the book, including the gazetting processes. So we'll have legislative services being part and parcel. Curriculum needs to look at what is available, what timetables are there, what is offered, what streams are in there. Rural education is part of it. These things cost money to move schools, to merge them. So financial planning and analysis is part and parcel of it. The movement of teachers. The movement of teachers from one pay point to the other, the determination of who then becomes the principal is an education human resource management issue. Infrastructure, for obvious reasons, they must provide infrastructure and transport and all the. So these committees are sitting at a national level to guide provinces. But provinces are also expected to replicate these structures. So as meetings sit at national level, there are meetings that also sit at provincial level with the very same officials that represent the different types of directorates that are implicated in this. So these committees are there to provide a platform to discuss and address and align policy matters. They are there to improve consultation issues. There is also a monitoring aspect, and there is also an aspect of receiving queries and complaints and address them. That is the mandate of this committee. So the DBE, because I said it's a provincial competence to merge into schools, because schools are situated at provincial level. We do look at whether notices were given. We do look at consultation processes. We do look at the gazetting processes, and we do look at the movement and all that. And what comes out every time when a school is to be merged or closed, the complaint is that we were not consulted. So that begins to get into another area of what is consultation in reality, because there is a school that will have 25 children. The department will engage the community and the SGB, and the community and the SGB will say, you're not closing our school and we don't want it to be closed. This school has been named after so and so. This school can't be, and whatever reason that they give, and the department goes ahead and say, we had you, but for the benefit of the children, we're going to merge or close. So the complaints will come in and say, there was no consultation. So there is a difference between actually what is consultation. Does consultation lead to consensus and agreement? But if it's for the benefit of the children, then the MEC might try and implement a measure of the school in case he realizes that these children are not getting any tuition at all in that particular school. That slide is just to indicate how the DBE moves around provinces and engage provinces and discuss with them and ensure that all the structures are in place and that provinces are following the guidelines to the latter. DBE has just approved roadshows on to provinces from the 13th of September to the 13th of October, where the DBE will be leading discussions on regionalization, merger and closure of schools in all provinces, where we intend to meet stakeholders. We intend to meet circuit managers just to re-emphasize the fact that it has to be done correctly, and meet traditional leaders, meet unions, and meet councillors, and that's what we'll be doing for the month of September until October. The reporting processes is that The team that meets with me in particular, we do have these regular monthly meetings, but we then report to senior management, the DDGs. We report to broad management on a monthly basis. And then DG also call DDGs in provinces and also at the DBE just to look at progress. It's a slow process from identification to consultation to putting resources. It can take a year or two in order to do that. And we'll deal with appeals. Some schools will appeal, and if we think it's reasonable, are given more time to rectify what needs to be rectified. All we need is that schools must be able to give us the sufficient number that will demonstrate that teaching and learning takes place. Those are graphs that indicate that the trouble is mostly in the Eastern Cape. It is in KZN, and it is in Limpopo. This is where you get a lot of small and non-viable schools and those that are misaligned. So each year, a province will then target a number of schools. Because you can't just do a wholesale and want to close every school that is. You have to plan and you have to deal with where it is doable, where you can build hostels, where you can have transport for the children. And that's why the Free State is doing it well, because they have built a number of hostels and put those children in there. Northwest has done it very well. Where there hasn't been movement is because of our own doing of the inability to provide things like scholar transport and all that. These are challenges that we have in the system. But this program doesn't have an owner per se. We depend on task teams that are brought together from province and national. The provision of scholar transport is a problem, especially in provinces where scholar transport is not under the department, but is managed by the Department of Transport. The provision of infrastructure is still a problem. It's a finding type of a thing that delays the process of implementation. Yes, we have a problem with stakeholders. Some of them, you'll meet them over and over again without any movement. There is still resistance. And this resistance normally comes in the form of protecting the teachers that are there and say the principal can't be moved and our teachers. And the teachers will also influence communities when they feel they don't want to move. But when you try to show them that a teacher that teaches math from grade 8 to 12 have 5 lesson plans to do every day, and when he set exams at the end of the year, 3 question papers for grade 12, 3 question papers for grade 11, and all these bits and pieces, then the teacher realizes that, no, I think I need to go to another school where this burden can be shared. And we still have political interference, especially councillors will come in and also interfere with the discussions that go on. And sometimes before the election period, When a community rises against the merger and closure of schools, politicians tend to reverse the decision to allow those communities because elections are coming. We have provided those documents. We've given you what FASA says, and then we've given you the terms of reference on how these task teams operate. We've given you guidelines. It's a blow by blow on what must happen before a school is merged or closed. We have also given standard parameters that talks to what a school is, how big must it be, and what the school must have. And those are your packages. And we requesting the committee to note the recommendation and support it. And thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Dr. Langa and Dr. Ntebe. I am noting hands, honorable members, that want to have a bite on the presentations as presented by DBE. There is a hand of honorable Sukers and Murwatsehla. Dr. Thembekwayo, Mama Sabela, Can we proceed in that order?
Thank you, Chair. With your permission, Chair, can I just keep my video off, Chair?
It's fine.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. I appreciate it. I would, as a courtesy, say I thank the department for their presentation. I want to say to the committee that this is one of the excellent examples where the ground and the presentation that gets put before Parliament is worlds apart. We've had a petition that we brought before this committee that dealt with a micro school in the Western Cape. And the conditions that needs to be met or the process that needs to be followed, none of those processes, at least four of them on the checklist, as that has been presented here by Mr. Ndlebe, in the case of Siyakugat VGK Primary, none of those conditions has been met. And the constitutional rights of our people on the in the rural areas, it is our role as parliamentarians to defend those rights, because those communities have a right to determine where their children are being taught, how their children are being educated. And this matter for me is a serious matter that the committee needs to really keep the department accountable for and accountable to, because one of the most egregious things that has happened with Siyakugat is that this committee was informed that Siyakugat was gazetted closed, but that closure was only gazetted in May. Even after the department came here, the provincial department, to present to this committee. And for me, that underlines the manner in which our rural communities are being treated. And then we have these very nice presentations that we need to give consideration for. I really find it unacceptable. Unacceptable. I'm going to ask quite a few questions, Chair, with your permission. We have been provided not provided with any statistics or figures that indicate how serious the issue is. I wrote to the DBE through the Chair asking for these figures. They have not been addressed in these presentations. So without figures, these presentations are largely meaningless, and I really want to have an understanding. I saw the lowest number was in the Western Cape. If we can get the schools identified for closure, a list of those schools by name. Nationally, 3,255 schools, over 257,000 learners, and over 115,000 educators are in schools under 135 learners and slated for closure, if we use what the department has given us here. That does not include those on short-term contracts and other workers like your cleaners, gardeners, maintenance, etc. There are no figures for those likely to be retrenched either. Siyakugat is a good example of this. That community in protest is keeping that school open. Those kids are being fed by community donations at the moment. We have young people that has been so-called part of this project, I'm certain, that has now been flighted here as an achievement. Those children are without any work. They are actually right now volunteering at that school. So it is an issue that is very close to my heart. I'm sorry, Chair. And I find it really for us as parliamentarians to take note of this as to how the department presents and what happens on the ground and our responsibility to keep the department accountable for what they say. In KZN, it's 1,005 schools, 82,677 learners, and over 5,000 educators. In the Northern Cape, one in five schools could be closed. This is as of September 2021. And the source list here is the ordinary school master list that comes from the DBE. So I have a major concern about the lack of oversight by Parliament over rural schooling and the lack of transparency and relevant information from the DBE and the Provincial Education Department. And I'm using Siyakugat as a case study for us to see in real time practically what it means and what is the real time consequences of this. When Mr. Ndlebe says sometimes kids go for weekends, let me put it to Mr. Ndlebe that, for instance, in this school, it's impossible for you to work out transports for those learners. That is one of the reasons why the parents did not agree and why the department didn't have a transport plan, but yet they closed the school. I'm talking about the provincial department. And if you are going to, and I'm going to ask questions around the research, because if children are only going to see their parents once a month, or whenever it is suitable for the department to transport them back to their parents, we must consider how much emotional and social impact it has on communities. So here's my question. I would like to understand, what is the status of my written questions? Did they reach the DBE? That's number one. Number two, when was the portfolio committee informed of the decision to move from a policy to a framework? When was this indicated to the public who provided their input on when public submissions was made? Then, was a socio-economic impact assessment done, as is required by cabinet when any policy is released for public comment? I also want to know the research that has been mentioned. There is no research on the DBE research repository and no research planned in your research plans up to 2023. So what is this research that is claimed to have been done? Has any research been done on the impact I asked previously that this will have on learners? What research do you have on learner outcomes, health, and socio-psychological impact on learners? And I want to actually say something concerning the issue of one of the elements that of consideration for quality education, extramural activities. How many schools actually in urban areas have extramural activities that we can say a full program is being run to ensure quality education? I can take you to my constituency now in the Western Cape and ask you that question in Lavendale, in South Peninsula, where are the extramural activities? Because we saw in the Free State a school, a micro school, with extramural activities. And that school children as a culture, arts and choir that we saw. I can't say the same in these urban areas, just as an example, if we talk about a requirement of quality education and the development of children. Then I have a very simple question. How many schools are targeted for closure? So if the framework can be provided to the committee, I would appreciate it. And I would also like for a request of a follow-up meeting once we have the facts and figures and the frameworks. Lastly, Chair, you have an engagement framework that was mentioned. What alternatives to closing schools are being developed? Now, in closing, this comment that I want to make is that I have firsthand experience of what it means for communities when these schools are being closed that has historical value to these communities. I also have experience of our provincial education departments are not following process that respects the constitutional rights of parents and children. And Siyakuchat is one of those. It is closed. It was closed, but it was not gazetted. 3 days before the MEC left her office, she signed in haste that document. So I know exactly how our community's rights are being violated. And we are getting these very nice presentations. Thank you.
Thank you. Principal?
I would ask you know, and everybody on this all-important platform, good morning. Chairperson, let me join the recent speaker and by welcoming and appreciating this to me, which is a very well-oiled presentation from DBE. Of course, we may agree that it is one thing to have such a very smart and clear presentation, but on the other side, it becomes another thing with regard to what is happening on the ground. We should not be oblivious of that. It is, Chairperson, the responsibility of the Department of Education in every country to provide the quality public education to its own children, because education is the core for any civilization or development in any given country. For the years that I served in this department, I can confirm that the principles of rationalization within the Department of Education is as indispensable as it is unavoidable. No wonder our own department, the department which we have summoned to this all-important portfolio committee, they have zoomed and ventured into this. Hence, we hear them reporting on the whole issue of merger of these small and unviable schools. It's a formidable must. It's impeccable, and it remains unavoidable. Research statistics, Mudula School, has proven and shown that all these small and micro schools make teaching and learning very difficult, if not impossible. This becomes so if the teacher-pupil ratio makes education an impossible task to implement. You see, the greatest challenge is the smaller the school. If you can go and zoom into the history of all performance, poorly performing schools, you will realize that almost more than 90% are those smaller schools with a low teacher ratio, teacher pupil ratio, less teachers, less learners, and the whole job is surrounded upon one person, and therefore failure to perform at the end of the year, making education unviable, if not impossible. However, Chair, let me indicate by saying, maybe it is the modus operandi that remains a challenge, of which it's a challenge which we must all face without sidelining any of those as the portfolio committee. You see, the Department of Basic Education is on course, but it is very possible that the implementers on the ground might be the cause of the trouble. And I would say, rather than to point a finger at the department, let us assist the department in coming up with viable modus operandi, which will make this a process of addressing rationalization, of which in this case we are talking about merging of school, a viable and a possible thing to be done. The extent to which the department is consulting should be brought to the spotlight. Because consultation is a relative term, Chairperson. To others, when you consult, you become so angry and so ugly to an extent that it is no longer seen as a consultation, but it becomes an instruction. A person behaves as if he is carrying a mandate which is not prepared to compromise even a single thing. So the level or the manner in which this consultation is being done, I think it's something which we must take very closely and try to correct it. Like I've said, that consultation in itself, it is a relative term. It can mean one thing to the other, dictatorship, and while to the other person, it is going to become a give and take. That is consultation. How is it being done when this merging of schools, closure of schools, is being done? Number two, the level of transport readiness. You see, Madam Dere has openly indicated well that where there is no transport, we will not be able to merge schools. It's a very sober statement from a departmental official. But are we sure that those who are on the ground, When they talk about the transport, they talk about the transport in the true sense of the word. Because we have seen and lost many lives of our kids because of transport which is not road, transport which are not roadworthy. I would say, in as much as we come with these very good and viable policies, let us also monitor what is actually taking place on the ground. That what we say on the paper is what is happening on the ground and practically so. So, Chairperson, I would say and plead with this honorable portfolio committee that let us assist the department in doing the right thing correctly so. Because this is as unavoidable and as it is indispensable. I so rest my case, Chairperson, but the report itself is well oiled and good. All what it needs is the support of this portfolio committee so that the right thing, provision of basic education to our, a quality basic education to our children be a viable thing. Thank you very much, Mr. Scoop.
Thank you, Dr. Tepekwe.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me just go straight to the issues that are problematic for me to accept. The first one is about the community consultation process. It's problematic as and demonstrated by the last presenter, who definitely said if the communities refuse, those that refuse, what is supposed to happen. They just overlook whatever they have said or done, and they continue with the process. It obviously means that they are not taken into consideration, and that it's a problem. Yes, we understand that the purpose of today's presentation is for us to note, but accepting it is a problem. It can be discussed on another day. As long as we have issues that are not clear or that are not in actual fact acceptable, we cannot be able to accept it. Furthermore, on the role of the district implementation team, what details or what entails the support of learners and their parents moving from rural or farm schools into the new schools? It just said the support, but we would like to know in details to say what type of support is that one. Furthermore, the fee schools, merging of fee schools with non-fee schools with reference to those that come from non-fee schools. The guideline document recommends that the learners be inherited from farm school to rural non-fee schools by be given on the same presentation. There is a suggestion for the review of the poverty score of the new or merged schools to determine its new ranking. This is problematic. What about if the new ranking creates a disadvantage for the learners and their parents financially, pertaining to the unaffordability of the school fees by those parents? Will it not create a problem for the parents and the learners as it may be? And lastly, to say, they say tablets are given to the learners at schools. My question is, what happens to the lost tablets? What is that plan in place for the replacement of the lost tables, either from the school through theft or being lost by the learners themselves? And I think we are going to have a lot of communities coming to our committee to report or present their dissatisfaction in this process, as we have had the Ziekwe Hut community's petition here, and observing the arrogant way in which the province responded to the poor community. So we are expecting the very same responses that would come from the very same presenters in protecting what they have presented to us today. So get the consultation process right, where the interest of the communities are taken into consideration. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Mama Sabela? Principal, can you lower your hand?
No, thank you very much, Chair. Chair, it is not clear how the implementation of the pillars of such a framework would be monitored or administered. If we could get clarity on how this framework is different, for instance, from the norms and standards the department largely failed to implement, especially in rural schools, is the first question. The second question, Chair, your slide on Pillar 2, you talk about mobilizing rural communities. We have lots of young people in rural areas who are qualified and yet unemployed. What strategies have you put in place to use them? Lastly, Chair, what is the budget of the Rural Education Directorate in the department? I ask because the funding allocation should indicate the department's seriousness with this matter. And how many people are there? Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Nadada.
Thank you so much, Chair. Before I continue, Chair, can I just check in my audible, Chair?
Yes, you are.
Thank you so much. I'm going to start with the rural framework, Chair. I just have three questions on that. The first one is that, you know, it's all good and well to have a rural framework. And I think the previous member that just asked the question now kind of hit the nail on the head. But also, I wanted to check whether are there any linkages with other departments such as rural development and agriculture, and that, you know, there are collaborations in terms of how to best make sure that this framework is effective, you know, from the department side. And secondly, budget-wise, you know, there's been a cut in terms of incentivizing rural teachers, you know, and there's this framework that says we want to improve the quality of education there. We must make sure that there's, you know, the curriculum offerings are in existence there. But then the very same people that are supposed to be doing that job in that particular area, you know, you've got a budget that's been cut of them, you know, being incentivized. So how do you encourage people to be able to participate in this framework? If, you know, the budget keeps on shrinking, particularly for those areas, or is there a plan to get a grant to make sure that this framework of the department is implementable? The third one, in terms of the national framework for rural education, is that, you know, I think it's said that in South Africa, there's, you know, the Department of Education and many other departments, you know, believes in this centralized, bureaucratic, overburdening kind of system. You know, we must draft a framework and a policy and this for everything, you know, when the basics are not done, you know. And then, you know, Mr. Ndebe presented here in the second presentation about the basic challenges that need to be overcome for us to make sure that the rural schools are actually quite effective. And it goes to very, very basic things. It doesn't require such a massive framework, you know, with teams that are centralized at the national and provincial level, and that will make a decision from, you know, the nonchalance of the offices without decentralizing these things to the school. And I think it's something that when we do draft policy, we need to think about, because policy is not, you know, supposed to be something that you sit in your air-conditioned boardroom and then draft a policy on how this thing will work in 3 hours of gravel in Colombia somewhere. Whereas you're supposed to be having a bottoms-up approach on developing a rural policy that is not going to be centralized, but it's going to be unique to the various circumstances. Because like you said, rural is not just rural because it says Lalini or it's in a farm area. There's different types of rural, peri-urban, rural farming communities. And in even them, they've got their own unique circumstances. And drafting policy as a generic thing, as if this will apply across the board, no longer works. Look at other countries that are surrounding us, the Seychelles, Kenya, other countries that are good in education, such as Finland. They don't draft policy based on a centralized system that we must control everything from, you know, the nonchalance of our offices at the top, but we must decentralize our policy making. Something that we need to think about. And for me personally, I don't think that the way in which this framework has been drafted will actually make any difference. You know, it's just maybe something that you need to put together, but that's just my view. But jumping into the rationalization presentation that has been presented here, I wanted to check, Mr. Ndlebe, has there been oversight done on previously merged schools to ascertain whether learners and teachers are happy to ensure the full integration of this particular process? And if that has been done, can we please get the results of those that oversight or that research that maybe have been done? There's also seen there is an appeals mechanism, you know, in the current act in education, you know, to appeal to the MEC regarding the rationalization of a school. But, you know, these appeals, have they been audited, you know, by the different, maybe the provincial departments or through an independent schools inspectorate or the school evaluation authority, as the case in the Western Cape? Have they been audited, you know, especially in circumstances schools and have been moved to areas that can inconvenience all parties involved, whether it's parents, learners, teachers, and so on, or even personal issues? Do we go into detail by case so that we ascertain, you know, the facts and audit that to see what is the best outcome for that unique grounded situation? As Honorable Sugars was putting the case here for fearful fact. So that's just my question. You know, what happened to, you know, to the schools and learners where the process was flawed but implemented anyway? You know, do we track those and where do we locate them? And I just want to put a few things here on this particular area, Mr. Ndlebe. I mean, there's a citation that the UN indicates that South Africa provides for, you know, over 99% of learners between, you know, the ages of 7 and 13 in terms of accessing education, but it doesn't actually measure the quality of education thereof. So would it then not be important, Mr. Ndlebe, to beyond looking at the fact that we're trying to say, look, there must only be grade R to 7, and then there must be grade 8 to 12, you know, and we still did, we've done oversight in various provinces, the Northern Cape, we've mentioned some, the Northwest and so on, still having, you know, different types of schools that, you know, got a shortage of grades and so on. And there's this framework that from a policy level, it's actually not implementable in other, you know, other provinces because, you know, it doesn't consider the different unique circumstances of those areas, those communities, those schools, let alone those provinces. And there's a policy that says, you know, you must have schools that start from grade R to 7 and, you know, from 8 to 12, and that's where we're trying to get to. Is it not important now for us to relook at some of these policies and some of our laws to kind of decentralize this centralized system that, you know, has this overarching view that, you know, education must be controlled up there when in reality on the ground it does not, you know, practically change over to that. Secondly, there are collaboration models or what you would call public and private partnership models that actually work for rural education or what you would term small non-viable schools, where those schools may be adopted, you know, by either an NGO, a private organization, or even a private school that wants to merge with those with that school to make sure that it's viable because it serves the farming community, for example, in the Free State somewhere in Ruvel. So, you know, is it not high time that we start looking at some more innovative, decentralized models to kind of make sure that we provide quality education for these learners. Not simply to say to the UN, yes, we give them access, despite what the quality is, at least they have access to these schools. Whether they are viable or not viable, then we give them access. Whether there's quality teaching or not taking place, we still give them access nonetheless, you know. But when you look at these schools, the small schools that you refer to that are non-viable, they're actually not producing quality in some instances, but in some instances they're producing good quality education because they are a small school that has got smaller classes and so on, and therefore they've got more attention given to learners. And more so than anything, they are in the community in which these learners reside. So education can't just be a commodity that says, you know, let's centralize this thing. If we draft the laws and policies there that we must rationalize this, then let's do it because we believe, based on the research that we've done, that small schools actually provide poor quality education, as Honorable Muratete was saying here, without any form of research whatsoever, whereas I could argue completely different to that. So I think it's high time the department thinks outside the box, you know, from where they develop policy and the framework thereof, that it shouldn't necessarily be, you know, centralized to a provincial department, centralized to a national level. How do we make sure that those schools are actually functional, give good quality education? What support and resources must we put in place? If we even have to go to a system where we say, in these areas that we have identified that are rural, in their different times, we provide school vouchers for these learners that they can access the school that they want to access, that can give them the best quality education, not necessarily force them to go to a public school or non-fee public school that still won't give them good quality education. And I think that's where the problem lies with some of these things that have been drafted. And it's something that we need to think about. And here I want to suggest that we do oversight in these some of these schools that have been touted for this pilot project that have been successful using the EAs, and really, I don't know whether it's a real thing that it actually has been piloted, that you know, EAs have been used to you know, to check whether this rural framework will actually work, or it was just, you know, the presidential youth initiative project, and you know, it was just part and parcel of that. So I think, Chair, we need to do oversight in these schools. And we need to ascertain whether this rural framework that has been put in and shared with us today and the reap outcomes and results are actually evident on the ground rather than seeing them just solely on these presentations. And I really genuinely don't believe that these centralized committees on a provincial and a national level will actually make any difference in making sure that we've got good quality education in rural areas. We're just simply forcing young children in rural areas to attend poor quality public schools because they just have to, and that's what the law says, and that's what the policy has been drafted to say, without any form of choice for parents or those learners to attend other different schools by different mechanisms or innovative ideas. Let alone that, the burden has been placed on the department to build schools on infrastructure, toilets, water, instead of collaborating even with public and private enterprises. And it is important for us to start looking at that and be honest with ourselves to make sure that we uplift those schools that are not performing or those communities that don't have access to good quality schools to have access to good quality schools and good quality education so that you can breach the inequality gap. But we won't breach the inequality gap by just centralizing control to provinces and national government in that instance. But this might be the Chair. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Honorable Atwan.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me also welcome and appreciate the two presentations that were given to us in this meeting, and also the supporting documents that we received to get, you know, assist us to get a clearer understanding of what transpires when there's a need to close the school or merge schools. And also the rural education framework that has been provided to us. I would also concur with members and not want to repeat some of the questions that they have posed, but maybe just to re-emphasize on the issue of the budget, because when we visited some of the schools in the Free State and Northwest, you could see that those schools are really struggling, especially the rural schools. You'll feel the difference, or you see the difference when you visit both the urban and rural schools. Now, the question of the budget, I think we need to get a response on how are they allocated, or how is the budget distributed? What is it that is required, and what is it that is looked into in making sure that the budget is appropriated fairly to all the schools? But secondly, Chair, I would also want to understand the level of consultation that is undertaken when the rationalization policy is applied, and whether does the department have a framework for such a consultation process, because what is a consultation to what Honorable Sukers has actually spoken to is not what the department or even the provinces actually has spoken to. So is there such a standard framework where we can say when this has happened, this is what is consultation as per a certain framework. But also going back to what we are here for, the petition of Honorable Sukers, I don't get a clear indication from the department or DBE whether they were part of the closing of this particular school, whether they were in the entire process up until the closing of the school, because there are certain allegations that are made by Honorable Sukers that what has been done by the province or what was never done by the province. So I would want to hear the national department, the DBE, speak to the entire process as they know when they've been closing or merging schools around the country. Was the same process done into the school in question today? But also I would like to understand the role of traditional leaders. I think one member asked it whether there's a proper consultation when such frameworks and policies are made. What is the role of traditional leaders in the framework as a critical stakeholder in rural areas? I've heard Mr. Ndlebe mentioning councillors, how they sometimes disrupt the processes of closing or merging of schools, mainly during elections. But I would also want to understand the role of traditional leaders, whether they are taken on board, whether they also been considered when such measures have been done. However, Chair, I would also want to, speak about the experience that I have personally when we're visiting some of the schools, even in the Northwest, that it was important to close some of the schools because of they were not really viable. They were not performing well. You'd get a school that has a 0% of pass rate and all those things. And when you see after the merger and you go and revisit such areas, you can see that there's a lot of improvement. And you can see that at least learners are able, especially those schools that learners are taken into the hostel, because now they don't need to travel every day, early hours in the morning and come back home very late. At home, they are most of the time tired and all those things. But you can see how now they perform and how, kids are happy, that they are able now to also enjoy their also their schooling. So those are some of the work that I think the framework and also the policies assisting mainly in rural areas where we see that some of the schools really are not in good condition, where you can have one teacher, you know, teaching, you know, those multi-grades kind of arrangement where they are not really performing. I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done and that we really need to revisit and look into how best we can assist such schools in those conditions. Chair, thank you very much.
Thank you. Honorable for the vote.
Good morning, Chair and colleagues, and thanks for the presentation. Chair, a lot has been said already that I would like to emphasize, but something that I would like to just mention is two or three concerns. For many years, in fact, in Parliament, we would have stood up or we would sit in portfolio committee, and we normally heat on the Western Cape for not closing the schools or rationalisation process as quick as other provinces. And it's good that Honourable Sukers brought this thing here, but the Western Cape is only one province of nine. So I think there should be a very clear report on when this process started in each province, how many schools were identified, and how many were dealt with, and whether they had specific challenges on fulfilling that circular that went out right from the beginning, or the policy, whatever you want to call it. And then I would also like to know, I know my colleague, Honorable Nodada, did speak about some of the issues around that, but I would also like to know, against who are we benchmarking? Are we taking successes from other countries, whether it's Africa, Europe, or wherever, and implementing it here? And then I would also like to raise a concern, because during oversights, we talk about the traditional leaders, and yes, they are a major stakeholder. But there are some across the country that are actually using this whole issue to hang on to power instead of looking after the education of our children. Because indeed, the presentation started off by ensuring that this is nothing else but to make sure our children get good education. And one can raise eyebrows or you can just accept it. But I think we must also be very open and honest. There are nine provinces and we should know why the challenges are. Where was it successful? Where wasn't it? And against whom and what are we really benchmarking? Thank you, Chair.
No, it's fine. Thank you very much, honorable members, for all the participation that we have made in the presentation. I've just got some few issues to raise as well to DBE. And I think about two members have raised the issue of the rural teacher incentives. Can we be told that what are most likely the challenges in the implementation of this rural teacher incentives? And then the issue of budget, what budget is allocated to implement? And I'm saying for the past 5 years, if anyone could just be able to say for the past 5 years, what is the budget that is allocated? And then I'm just interested in knowing what is the implication of of a policy versus a framework. And now the last one is to check with the department. The policy in question, this one, the of rural
schooling. Is there a way that we can get it like on hyperlink? We will just press the link and be able to get it. But, or rather, not only this one, but policies related to the department. Is there a way that we can get them on hyperlink so that when there are issues like they were in the previous meeting with the rural schooling, we are able to just go to the link and have the and have these policies on that link. Those are the issues from my side. I'm gonna then allow Ms. Gaya to lead the responses.
Thank you, Chairperson.
I see that yes. DG is now here.
I was going to say, if DG is in the house, maybe we should allow him to go first, and then if he wants, he can identify.
Thank you. DG is quasi up. Thank you,
Honorable Chair. My profuse apologies, Honorable Members. I got kicked out because I'm out in the field. I just want to contribute. The network is not good yet. Chair, please allow me here to continue to make 3 points. I want to thank honorable members for their participation in the discussion of the two presentations that we have made, which talk to the nature of our country, the rurality of our country, small and unviable schools, which is a universal phenomenon. The first point that I want to make is that the framework is a policy, but it's a policy that would know, but it is a policy. The second issue is that governance in South Africa is delineated into 3 spheres, which we all know about. I really don't want to take your time about something that you know. Every sphere of governance is delineated and the role is defined. The national sphere is to develop policy, monitor, and support. The provincial policy, sphere, is to provide for education and ensure, provide guidance up to school level. And then the operational level, of course, is at school level. So what we do as DBE is defined by the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa, including the development of frameworks, the development of policies. Otherwise, you know that we have a litigious society. Not our area. Honorable Nodada, with respect, the issue of the development of the framework and the policies is the responsibility that the Constitution has given to the national sphere. We're carrying that out within the purview of what is allowed by law. The third point that I want to make at provincial level, DBE in monitoring provinces, does DBE ensure that there's full compliance with the Act? And my humble request is that we look at those facts that are on the table, and then the facts must guide us as to whether the process has been followed or whether the legislation.
Can you take over, Ms. Kerr?
Thank you very much, Mr. Person. I think the DG... DG, we cannot hear you. You keep breaking up and coming in. So the chairperson is asking me to take over. Is that fine?
That I wanted to make the rest, I suppose you will cover. My humble apologies. The network is very bad where I am.
Thank you, Chairperson. If I may come in after the DG. I think the DG is just making the points around what we are guided by in terms of legislation and policy. And how we go about, you know, using this as a yardstick for all the work that we do in the DBE. I think over and above that, you know, just to respond broadly to the issues that have been raised around budget, the department, in the allocation budget, we don't categorize our budget in terms of what goes to rural and what goes to urban. We have an allocation that goes to schools. It's guided by the legislation and policy that DG has referred to. Over and above that, we also have norms and standards that influence the way in which we do schools receive staffing. There's a particular norm and standard that's used, school staff provisioning, which then gives teachers a number, it's attached to number of learners, and then you get your number of teachers that you qualify for. And this cuts across in terms of the allocation of budget within the entire system, and all schools and all provinces use these policies. And then in terms of how it goes, further down into, you know, how the types of schools that we then allocate to, it's then that these factors that Mr. Ndlebe has spoken to around number of learners and number of teachers that then put a small rural school that has under the number of learners that's supposed to be there for the school to exist, it then puts them to a disadvantage because you will have one teacher that will have to cut across teaching all 19 learners in different grades, multi-grade teaching, and the consequence of that he has tried to explain in his presentation, and it has a negative impact on the quality of teaching and learning, and it has a negative impact on how these learners perform in terms of examinations, and it has an impact in terms of ultimately the opportunities that these learners would get if they have to go out or want to enter into university or want to have skills that can allow them to get into, you know, competing with other learners within our country or in the world for that matter. So those are the factors based on our policies that we have, which DG has referred to. That then influence, you know, how we do our allocations. And there are broad principles and broad policy decisions that are linked to how you allocate budgets. So there isn't a budget that can be allocated for rural directorate or rural schools because we have schools in South Africa. We don't categorize them according to budget. They all, you know, follow the same process of how we allocate the budget. I'm going to ask Mr. Ndlebe to get into the detail of the technical questions that have been asked. Mr. Ndlebe, you can answer the questions that you think you're able to, and then I'll check which ones you've covered, and I'll come in afterwards to see which ones you have not answered. Thank you very much.
Thank you, DDG, and thank you, Chairperson. I think the burning ones are around the school in the Western Cape that has been closed. Most of the questions emanate from that particular school, and it's like, has the DBE looked into that, and what does the DBE say around it? Facts are as follows. The school had 19 learners. Those 19 learners were scattered through grade 1 until 6. If you use the teacher-learner ratio, it's a primary school, it's one teacher per 40. So it means those 19 learners were allocated one teacher who's supposed to be the principal, the departmental head, the post-level one teacher and everything. And we're saying it's not doable for one person to teach 19 children in different grades. In our presentation, we indicated that a learner that is in grade 1, for example, needs 23 hours per week, needs about 8 to 7 hours to be taught a language. And if it goes on and on with all those differences, it means for the better part of the day and the better part of the week, those children are not receiving tuition. And there's no way they'll be able to cover the prescribed curriculum. Now, the 19 children, if you are to look at the budget, say each learner is funded by the department at 1,000 rand per annum. It means these children, the school will get about 19,000 rand per year. How do they service the machinery? How do they pay for additional services like water, electricity? How do they cover any other expenses that is in there? Even if school parents were to pay additional fees to that school, it will not be able to cover all this. So that is the research and the consultation that we believe has taken place. The province has indicated that they met with the SGB, and there were minutes to that regard which were not questioned. And that meeting has taken place with the SGB, followed, to give you a specific date, it was 18 September 2020. On the 22nd of October, they then met with the community members in that thing called consultation, and these things were discussed in there. And what has come up there is that DBE says, we can't say there was no consultation. Consultation did take place, but the answer that came from the community and the SGB is that they were not approving, they were not agreeing with the department to make. So we should not say there was no consultation, but there was no agreement that you can say. But the department is saying, how do we go on ensuring that these children are getting quality education when in actual fact they are not taught at all? They then said the policy allows us to identify a place where these children can be located. A school was identified, Teske Gedent Primary School, which had hostel facilities where these 19 children can easily be accommodated together with others, and then they could have then a proper timetabling and a proper teaching. So as far as the department is concerned, a challenge was identified, a small non-viable school, no quality education taking place because of those conditions, which are not the creation of their own. Now the department creates an environment where they could be taken, and consultation not agreed, but at the end, the MEC had to make a decision, and that decision is that we need these children to be receiving quality education, and therefore, I hear you what you're saying, communities, I hear what the SGB is saying, but for the sake of the children are going to be moved to this particular. So those are the issues around that affect that school. It becomes difficult to even provide nutrition to children that are small because of budgetary constraint and all those type of things. Now, the question around social impact, psychological impact,
versus the learning that the children are receiving becomes an issue to be looked at. But we need to decide which one is more important, having children spending hours and hours when one teacher is focusing on a group of learners and cannot teach them. We're not saying we don't deal with multi-grade. We're not saying multi-grade is dead, but we're saying there is a minimum number which is permissible to do this multi-grading so that the children can benefit themselves. Now, there are questions that Honorable Sugat has sent to the department. Now, because these are provincial competences, we need to go back to the provinces and collect the information that she's requesting us to bring. And we will provide that type of information. We couldn't bring this information here because it's not information that is sitting in the Department of Basic Education, but it is all over provinces. So that information with questions of how many schools are targeted, how many are going, were closed, and we do have those questions that she has sent to us. Now, it's true the department has a responsibility to provide public education, but under these circumstances, it is unavoidable, as Honorable Murotesa has indicated, that we have to try and ensure that every child gets. But there are questions about consultation, which honorable members are saying probably is not being done correctly. And we will look into that. The issue of school fees and non-fee school and all that. Issues of school fees have nothing to do with learners, are not supposed to affect learners at any in any point. If children are taken to a fee school, but they are unable to pay school, it's not a determining factor whether they have to be in that school or not. SASPA says children need to be admitted at any school, irrespective of their ability to pay schools and all that. That goes into issues of school exemption. It goes into issues of how the department compensates for school exemption. So school fees should not feature in the measures, the closing of schools, whether it's a rural school or it is a township school. It should not feature at all. I do not deal with issues of the policy, but I'm looking only at the measure and closure of school. But Honorable Dada, were oversight done on schools that have been merged and closed? Yes, there is oversight that we have done on schools, especially those that have appealed and showed that dissatisfaction around it. So it's something that we can prepare for the portfolio committee and provide to you. What was the complaint? How did you intervene? How was the funding? And I can tell you that there are schools that when we go before they are closed, we overrule it and allow them to continue for reasons that we'll indicate when we give you all those. The misaligned schools. I said we do not merge and close at all costs. There can be a misaligned school in a particular village which is not connected to any other. It doesn't mean the department will have at all costs close those schools and merge them. We've given them conditions, but the department must find ways to resolve those issues before they can deal with the merger and closure of schools. Yes, there are schools that are doing well under those circumstances, and they may not be subjected to this, but key is the quality education that is provided there. Honorable Adjuns also came to the budget, how a school receives the budget. The smaller the school, the more difficult it will be to find a budget that is going to assist it to cover all the expectations that are supposed to be there. Honorable, you also ask about the role of traditional leaders. When we consult, traditional leaders are key to the culture of teaching and learning in a particular environment. So if their schools are going to be affected, yes, provinces need to consult with them, need to indicate to them what is going on and how it affects them. And most of these schools were established by traditional leaders, especially in the Eastern Cape rural areas, even in KZN. So we can't just go as a department and not involve them. So communities need to be involved for the benefit of the learners in turn and educate them. That's what the consultation should be. The report that Honorable Van der Walt is requesting is the same report that Honorable Seeker is requesting, which is saying we will go to the provinces, we will collect this, and we will bring it back to the portfolio committee to indicate how far we have gone and what are the challenges, how many schools, how many are targeted, what are the challenges in others, which schools are going to be left as they are because of compelling reasons that might have been given, and which ones we cannot afford to allow them to continue. It is that type of report that we will prepare, Honorable Chairperson and Mrs. Bain.
Thank you, Mr. Lebe. I think the questions have largely been covered in terms of our incentives. And we have a policy as well on
thank
recording
you.
Recording in progress.
Things, just to add to what Ms. Gaya has responded to about the rural incentive, it's a colloquial name for that. The real name for that policy is that incentives to teach in areas that are difficult to attract teachers. It is not confined to rural areas. It could be in a township because of violence and other things, then it's very difficult to attract people to those areas. Actually, the notion of rural incentives was borrowed from the Department of Health. But in education, it's a policy to attract teachers to areas that are very difficult to do so. Just to add, the reason why the policy has been withdrawn, I think it's Honorable Nodada who asked the question. The first one is that there's no longer funding to implement that policy. There's no longer funding. I was among the generations of managers and leaders who started to implement that policy. When I was in the Northwest. And
recording in progress.
Receive quality education, and that being paid for 100% by the state. In fact, countries, we had Zimbabwe the other time, which visited us, the Minister of Zimbabwe and her team. At some point, we had their colleagues from Kenya. They are very interested in how we've been able to consolidate our schools in the rural areas and look at how, you know, they could implement some of the aspects of the consolidation, that enclosure of our farm schools. Chair, thank you very much. Profuse apologies. I could get into the minds of many and get broadband rollout reaching all parts of our country so that we are able to communicate like anywhere else. But once more.
None recording in progress.
And we need to take note of that as a committee and not allow for this to continue to happen in Parliament. There is the issue that we have asked, which we didn't get an answer on. It is very telling what the department does not answer. They have not answered us on the socio-economic assessment. They've not answered us on that. We know that in the Northwest, we had a school on oversight where the principal actually mentioned this to the committee to say that again, it had to do with the closing of schools and moving kids from his school to a township school. So what the department does not answer, the committee needs to notice. And we need to notice the failure of the department to answer on the detailed question and the lack of preparation to give us what we have asked for. The issue, the other issue that is also highlighted of what is not answered is the issue with reference to a policy that is now called the framework. The failure to follow the process in terms of cabinet that you need to have, it is what they call common cause, that I'm learning the phrase, that you need to have an SEIA when you are putting a policy forward. It's easy, the department could have answered that. I want to make those comments, Chair, and I want to note to the committee that none of the questions in terms of detail the department has answered. I'm repeating that, and it's unacceptable. And as far as Sirkuchat is concerned, DBE has failed to act. They were part of it. They know exactly where. So if next week, I am trusting that the DBE can then defend their actions when we bring before them what the failures have been where the school is concerned. Because today, they have actually married themselves to the position of the provincial department. And I care nothing in which the province it happens. It's about our people. I don't care who in which province it is. Thank you.
Honorable Natara.
Thank you so much, Chair. Chair, I think maybe the tea and the coffee with the DG is long overdue between me and him. With all due respect, Chair, as much as we all know the different spheres of government and their roles and responsibilities, I think we know that quite intricately. As much as policy making is the responsibility of the national government, policymakers can't make policies based on what they think should be in the policy. Policy should always be decentralized. It should come from a bottom-up approach so that it actually is implementable. Otherwise, then, you know, it just becomes a nice fairy document, DG. And it's important for us to do a rethink. That's what I'm trying to provoke here, a rethink about how do you put together these policies, these frameworks, so that they're actually practically, one, implementable, and they can make a tangible impact on the ground? Because the reality of the situation is this. When I read this framework, I can tell you now, let's go to Kolobeni, DJ, you know, and I'm sure you've been there. Or let's go to Emahlubini, you know, and I'm sure you've visited some of these places. And we need to make sure that we make policy that is practically implementable in those areas. And we can't just make a blanket approach when the circumstances and the environment are completely different. This just goes to show with my second point, Chair, that there was a unanimous agreement amongst education ministers that they must scrap the incentive policy, whether it's rural, whether it's difficult to teach, whatever the center, because it was imbalanced in terms of implementation. You know, I don't know whether the problem is the policy was the actual implementation. You know, again, it just goes to show that there's some form of detachment when you centralize everything and centralize control of decision making at a level in which, you know, people might not necessarily know the impact on the ground. And I can tell you now, there are hundreds and hundreds of teachers that write emails to me, write SMSs to me, or even WhatsApp, or even call. They want to quit. They can no longer drive those roads because there's no incentive there. They don't have the motivation to go teach there. Yes, it's all well and good to have a framework. But if that framework is not implementable on the ground and it is able to provide good quality education for those children in those schools, in those rural areas, then it's all well useless. Because if you're going to take away the very same thing that motivates the people that are supposed to provide that good quality education on the ground, away from them, then what is the point of you developing any form of document for it to be implemented? Because it won't be practically implementable, let alone be tangibly implemented in those areas. And if these are things that we need to do a rethink about when we make these decisions, I'm not saying that DG, let's not have a play our responsibility and role of a developing policy at a national level and all these things that are defined in law, all the things that are defined in law and our responsibility, we all have the responsibility to do that. Even us in Parliament, we've got this responsibility of doing oversight. How we do oversight, and making it effective is then a different story. Same thing, it's all good to develop policy, but how to make it effective on the ground is then like another different story. And whatever you've framed must be able to be implementable. So it's time for a rethink. And I don't know whether there's a plan, DG, when this rural the incentive policy has been taken away, that is supposed to motivate good quality teaching and taking skills that you wouldn't ordinarily find to those areas that are difficult to teach, whether there's an alternative to what has been done, and maybe you can give us a feedback on whether there is an alternative to that. And that's literally the point that I'm trying to make, and to see what kind of innovations that should be put in place in our policy making process to make sure that we actually improve those circumstances, rather than just simply saying, well, there's a South African Schools Act there, there's an Employment of Educators Act there, there's the laws on basic education, and then we just stick and go through with those as in motion because they exist, and we have no mechanisms in place to say, how do you best refine these to work in the different areas and the different unique circumstances we find ourselves. And that's the question we should always ask ourselves as policymakers. So I think, DG, that's the point that I'm trying to make. And Chair, just on a separate note to this, and I just want to put it to you while we're in the meeting. I think there's a need, Chair, outside of this particular topics we discussed today, that we maybe invite the Department of Home Affairs that has made a decision about some permits that were given to foreigners, especially Zimbabweans at some point in time, which have brought skilled teachers, which some of them actually do teach in these rural areas that are no longer going to be allowed to teach there, so that we can be able to kind of get what solutions the department has for instances like that, where we're losing skills, particularly in those areas that have been attracted over time. So those are just 3 points I wanted to raise. Thanks.
No, thank you very much, members. Those were the follow-ups. I'm not sure if DG is still here. Do you want to respond to what has been raised by members?
Yeah, no. With respect to the issue of the poor taking the department or anyone to court, I never mentioned that. I talked about a litigious society when it comes to operating in the sphere that you are not supposed to operate, responding to Honorable Nodada. Question. Honorable Sukers might have missed my point there. But let's wait for the process that she's referred to. If we have erred, we'll be bold enough to say, look, we've made a mistake. But from what I've been told, the facts that are before us are as we have presented them. And I'm sure we might differ in how we look at those facts, but we have done our best. We've dealt with those facts to the best of our ability. And where we're sitting, the explanation that Mr. Ndlebe gave is what the department has done. Honorable Nodada, I also agree that maybe time is long overdue for us to have tea or coffee. My view is that our policies allow for diversity. But I also agree with you, you know, although by law, National Education Policy Act, we are obliged to consult on every policy that we issue out. And we do follow processes of CS policies of government, of doing an assessment on the policies or even legislation that we're issuing out. We follow that process of government. But maybe we need to find some time to do that. But remember, Honorable Nodada, if there's lack of uniformity in the implementation of our legislation and policies, people can also take us to court. If the flexibility and diversity is not justifiable and that cannot be defended, they can take us to court. But if flexibility and diversity is allowed to take local context into account, there I agree with you. And we try our best to make sure that we accommodate that. Thank you very much, Chair. That would be my response so far. We might not agree on all of these things all the time, but I fully respect the views of the committee and we'll do our best to address these matters to the best of our ability. The interest of the learner would be paramount in every decision we make. I repeat, the interest of the learner will always be paramount in decisions we make. Thank you, Chair.
No, thank you very much for the responses or for that response, TG. I think one would notice that there's quite a lot of, or members are raising dissatisfaction in a manner in which the responses have been raised. But one would ask that where members feel that there's more that the department must do in terms of responding, or rather the suggestions that came that we would have to take an oversight and go and see the schools that were mentioned, which are rural by the department. Probably that's what also we will have to do, so that we are able to see what has been raised here and what is happening on the ground. For now, I think let's just allow the department to leave us so that we can proceed with the minutes of the previous meetings. I think this is a matter that we will have to come back to. Maybe we must leave it on that note. Thank you very much, DG, Ms. Gaya, and everybody, the presenters.
Thank you very much, Chair. Thank you, Honorable Members. Thank you, colleagues.
Thank you very much.
Chair, you did not explain to us who was Thabo.
But also, how do I know?
You're going to throw it up on the sideline.
No, make investigations, Chairperson. We want to be safe on this platform.
I think Thabo is still in the meeting. Let's just check. Can you help me check, comrade members?
Who is Thabo?
Thabo never responded. We called him many a times.
Chef?
Yes?
You didn't respond to this thing of mine and Norma Fed.
Who did not respond? Is it me?
Yeah, I said you must invite the Department of Home Affairs to explain to us what's going to happen to those teachers there in those rural areas. They come from the lab, the science.
It's a political statement that they...
Rwanda to respond to political statements.
No, Thabo has left us. He left.
This thing is a setup. You leave it there and it talks.
I'm not talking. Serious.
But you can ask the Department of Education, Moswai Home Affairs.
No, because
we must find out how many South African teachers we have who are unemployed.
Then you tell a lot.
Yeah.
And if there are issues, they must flag them there.
Yeah.
But I'm saying the law, Honorable Adorns, has been passed by the Department of Home Affairs. So then it affects not just teachers, it's health and other, you know, departments. So we want to check what exodus is going to be there from the Department of Education. So it's something that I think we should discuss.
And I'm saying basic education, I think they can respond to us on that matter.
Then we must invite them to present.
Exactly.
Okay. Nolthando, can you fly to the minutes, please? The first set of minutes. Principal, please, order.
But the meeting is dead.
It's not dead. What is dead? You can't have your own things near there at home.
Where is Thabo?
Thabo is gone. Members, these are the minutes of the 14th of June, where we had a briefing on the status report on the implementation of the Portfolio Committee recommendation on an oversight visit of the Western Cape Provincial Education Department. Also had the briefing on the fourth quarter report, 21-2022. First page is the attendance of members, as you can see. And second page, and the officials from DBE and Ministry and Western Cape Department. And then there we welcomed everybody and the delegation from the Western Cape, which was led by their MEC. We had a presentation by the Western Cape Department. And then those were our observations and questions. And then we had responses from the Department of the Western Cape, which were led by Mr. Walters. That's the Western Cape part. And then after they have left, we had the department that have briefed us on the fourth quarterly report, which of course we did receive that presentation. And then after that, we considered the minutes of the 7th of June. And then there were issues of matters arising, which was the issue of the itinerary of Mpumalanga, which has passed, and the Bella Bill submission. We have requested a special meeting for the submissions, which we have done. That was during the recess, and then we have allowed for an extension. And then the adjournment was 22:48. Any corrections? In the absence of corrections, can I allow members to adopt their minutes?
Chairperson, I've raised my hand. And I move to adopt the minutes.
Thank you, Honorable Adjunct. Any second?
Chair, I'm moving for the adoption. For the seconding.
Where are you? You are busy with that kid of yours now. Thank you very much, Honorable Itziye. The second set of minutes. Okay, this is the second set of meeting which we had on the 28th of June at 6 as well, where we have considered the minutes of the 14th, and then we had an engagement on the consideration of the submission of Bella Bill and consideration on the extension of the deadline. Page one is the attendance. And then we have welcomed everybody. And it was constituency period, of course, but then we had to discuss this Bella Bill. And we had a briefing by the secretariat, which was led by Mr. Brown, on how are the Bella Bill submissions. And then also the content advisor, Mr. Mchekwane, had also briefed us. And that's what the members have raised. And then we have resolved that the deadline for the submissions will be extended to the 15th of August. And then the department responded to issues raised by members regarding the inclusion or omission of the clauses in current bill. And then the secretariat submitted a report on the content and context of summarized written submission comments on the bill to include the breakdown of the percentages presented by the GOGO. And then the committee agreed to a timeline and opportunities for oral submissions. The committee considered oral submission for specific groups. And then all submissions received after initial deadline to be accepted and processed. And then the chair, in concluding, alluded to the third term parliamentary program, okay? And then we have adjourned the meeting at 7:02. Any corrections? In the absence of corrections, can we get an adoption of these minutes?
Chairperson.
Principal?
I rise to move that this minute be adopted as a true reflection of what transpired on that day in question.
Thank you, Principal. Any seconder?
Second, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Adwans.
I'm standing on behalf of Nodad. Thank you.
Can we get the third set? Oh, the third set, this is the meeting we had on the 30th of August. It was last week where we had a briefing from both the Department of Basic Education and ECD on the, and Basic and Social Development on the ECD migration. First page is the attendance.
and second page and third page and fourth page. And then we have welcomed both of the ministers that were in the meeting, and then they both addressed the meeting. And then there was a presentation which was done by both the departments. It was a joint presentation, by the way. And this was the committee observations and questions. And the responses which were given by Basic Education. And social development, and then the ministers responded at the end. And then we had a conclusion, and then we couldn't adopt the minutes because of the time constraints. You would remember that meeting was, there were a lot of issues that were So these are the minutes, honorable members. Any corrections? In the absence of corrections, can we adopt the minutes?
Yes, Chair, no correction. We're moving for the adoption.
Thank you, honorable. Is there any seconder?
A second, Chair.
Thank you very much, honorable, at once. Thank you very much, members, for your participation in the meeting of today. As we all know that there is a sitting today at 2, which we are going to be part of joining virtually. And then we are going to have our normal meeting next week, Tuesday. As things stand now, the meeting is adjourned.
Who is Thabo?
Long live
is your man there from Venda.
Why are you still keeping back then?
Siwela must respond to that.
Our principal said Thabo is from Honorable Siwela's constituency.
That man is from Limpopo.
Sorry, otherwise, thanks very much, and everybody.
Thank you, comrades.
Sorry, Chair. The secretary is asking to speak, Chair.
No, Sando.
Sorry, Chair. There's still a draft report on the fourth quarterly report of the department.
There's still something we need to adopt?
Yes, sir.
No, I thought I saw 3. Okay, you can bring it. Are the members still here? Who left? Who's still here?
I'm here,
sir.
Okay. Yeah, sorry. I thought we had only 3 sets. No, it's 5. And you can bring them. It's not Tando. Oh, okay. This is the fourth quarterly report. Then, the meeting we had on the 6th of what? Is the 6th not today?
The 6th of September.
It is 6th of September was today. Was okay. On the 14th of June, it was meant to be what? I don't know what that 6th is meant for there on top. The 6th is today.
It means we are considering this report today, Chair.
Today?
Yes.
Okay. Otherwise, we had the presentation on the 14th of June, ne?
Yes.
Oh, okay. No, then it's fine. We can proceed. Okay, then the committee, we have considered the fourth quarterly report, which is 2021-2022. That is the introduction. As we have mentioned, we have considered this on the 14th of June. And then those are the performance indicators and targets by the departments, the major highlights which the minister led in presenting. And the DG followed suits, and they were presented per program. The achievements of the fourth quarterly report. You can proceed. Like I've mentioned, they were presented per program. Mm-hmm. And that's the budget for each program. You can proceed. That's the allocated budget for that quarterly report and the expenditure. And then those are the observations from members. And then the responses, which were led by the DG. And Mr. Parayaji and the CFO Kuno and Advocate Mesa, the DM and Dr. Polia. And then on the recommendations, these are the recommendations that we have made, that the department will have to ensure that the directors are educated on the important role and functions of members of parliament, and that the department must ensure that members receive adequate responses to any question raised, that queries are not being ignored within 7 working days after adoption. The Department of Basic Education ensures schools with LTSM shortages were assisted with any shortages as a matter of agency. That the Department of Basic Education continued to support and assist underperforming schools within the system to ensure improved performance, and that the department must share the following reports with the committee. The schools with access on the online learning and the details of official serving on the BEAT committee. A copy of the parental consent for learners participating in Teams and PELS, and a detailed report on the 10 legal cases processed by the legal services with 10 results and status. So those are the minutes of the fourth quarterly report that we had on the 14th of June. Any corrections? Can we adopt then the fourth quarterly report?
I move to adopt, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Adonis. Any second?
We second, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Lizie. The meeting is really now adjourned. Thank you very much, Honorable.
Hey, thank you, Chair.
Bye.
Where is Thabo?
Honorable Lizie, what do you want to do with Thabo?
Recording stopped.